Welcome to the Honeycomb Podcast. We're bringing you a special collab with Visa Wellington on a Plate to present the Wellington Food Story Speaker Series, taking place at the Museum of New Zealand, Te Papa Tongariwa. In each episode, you'll hear about Wellington's unique past and present food stories, as told by Wellingtonian chefs, historians, and storytellers. On this episode, we're going back to the 80s and 90s dining scene with Lois Daish, Martin Bosley, Grant Allen, and Julie Clark.
Ko te ahumairangi, te moanga, ko pai kawakawa te awa, ko Sarah Meikle taka ingoa, no te whanganui atara aho, kia ora. Good afternoon. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Sarah Meikle and I'm the Festival Director of Visa Wellington on a Plate, and it's a pleasure to welcome you all here today to the third of the Wellington Food Story Speaker Series presented by Te Papa here at Te Marae. I'd like to thank Lauren Campbell, Ian Crow, and the Te Papa team for their support in making this speaker series possible and for welcoming us to this beautiful venue. Today we're in for a real treat as we reminisce about the heady dining days of the 80s and 90s here in Wellington. To lead us on this journey back in time, it's my great pleasure to introduce Kelly Brett. Kelly is the owner and editor of New Zealand's Superb Cuisine magazine. Despite being an Australian by birth, Kelly is quite possibly one of the most, if not the most, knowledgeable person in New Zealand on the who, the what, and the where of all things dining, eating, and producing in New Zealand. Since Kelly has taken over the reins of Cuisine magazine, the publication has been given a new energy and is now certainly top of my list when it comes to favourite food publications. Please join me in welcoming Kelly, and she'll introduce you to our panellists today. Kia ora.
Sarah said I had to make an entrance, so... thank you for that lovely intro. And I'm so excited to be here today with this lot because you would never know. I know I hide it well, but I'm an 80s girl. And I'm told that Wellington was the culinary capital in those days. Sarah will, of course, tell you that it still is. I'm the editor of Cuisine and it's a national magazine, so I'm not allowed to comment on that. But it was such an exciting time, and it's such an exciting time now with the New Zealand food story. And these guys were the legends in those days that were directing it all and running it all. So I'm so pleased, and they need no introduction, but I'll do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. So Grant Allen, who was at Pierre's and is the man behind this amazing series of dinners that are going to be unfolding later in the week, Martin Bosley, who had many hats, but at that time was Brasserie Flip, was the main contender, and Lois Daish, who I've just met, and I'm fangirling just so hard at the moment, it's embarrassing, so if I gush all the way through this, please forgive me. But Lois apparently had Brooklyn Bar and Grill, and Julie Clark, who had Clark's Food Merchants, and of course still has the much-beloved Floriditas, that was one of the first places when I first came to Wellington. Sarah dropped me at my hotel and said, walk that way for Floriditas, so... an iconic restaurant that's still very, very much at the forefront. So, all four of you, first I'd like to ask you to, and you can all jump in any way, and if you get into a scrum along the way, I'll sort it out, but you can all, you know, I'm not going to point the mic in any direction. But maybe just on this occasion, if we go along that way, and Grant, you start off by just telling us a little bit about Pierre's at that stage. What was the concept there, and who were you targeting at? Who was your customer?
Okay. It was very much based on, it was the beginning of kind of BYO licensing becoming legislated in New Zealand, and it was very much French bistro style, given that the starter, or the person who started the restaurant, Pierre Meyer, was Swiss French, and so it was very classic French bistro with a blackboard menu written in French. Who were we targeting? We were targeting anyone and everyone, and we seemed to attract, you know, quite a broad spectrum of people. I think it was also the time where dining out became a bit more casual, a bit more relaxed.
Mm. So, okay. Yeah. That's very good. And you were at the time, you started in the kitchen?
Yeah,
you were working out the back and then you went into the front?
I started working there, then I became a partner. I worked in the kitchen for 7 years. So essentially I never trained as a chef. I kind of learned in the kitchen. And then I moved out front of the house, yeah.
I still can't grant front of house. Later. It's like, I just, that must have been quite phenomenal.
Well, I was very quiet.
I cannot imagine that at all. Martin.
Flip. Yeah, well, God, I think everybody's got a memory of Flip. I mean, Flip closed, I think, probably about 14, 15 years ago now, and there still wouldn't be a week that goes by that someone doesn't mention that restaurant to me in some form, whether it be it was our favourite restaurant or our son was conceived after a night dining there, which I've heard a lot of those stories. I've got a lot to be thankful for, apparently, or blamed for. And Flip was... it was just, I don't think any of us said, we didn't intend it to become the restaurant that it became. You know, we just wanted to do a fabulous big restaurant. Nothing had been done like that before. And it just became a juggernaut, which at times it felt like we barely had control of the reins of. And that was largely driven by the clientele that came in, who just, you know, everything that we did, they accepted and then demanded more, which sort of kept pushing this amazing relationship that we had with our diners. It was almost symbiotic, where we would do this and they would go, that's great, give us that. And and we just, you know, so it was constantly sort of meeting expectations and exceeding them. And it was just a blast, you know. It was a place that people came, whether it be, you know, advertising agencies, you know, like no one knew how to lunch like an advertising agency. It was
the long lunch, the expense account.
It was just mad. Oh, yeah, you know, and, you know, we sort of had Euro vintage on speed dial for more vertically coke, because it would be, you know, you'd regularly get nailed at lunchtime. You'd need more for the afternoon. And,
yeah.
So, you know, that was the home of that. And then, you know, lunches would stretch into dinners through to people who had, you know, hardly any money but wanted to come along and sit there and soak up. You know, like students that came in, you know, they became, you know, young customers, and as Flip aged, so did they, and they became mature customers bringing their kids in. You know, it was quite dynamic like that. And it just, you know, it was a contemporary space.
And you had two rounds there, didn't you? Because you were there and then you left and went back again?
Tours of duty, we call it. Yeah. It was just, yeah, I did the first couple of years and then I left and went to Port Douglas in Far North Queensland for 5 years. To deal with my anger management issues, which is probably more anger than less management that was going on, and then came back after 5 years and then plugged away. And I came back basically as Dean died, you know, who was you know, one of us. It was Marcus, Dean, Tim, and myself involved in that restaurant.
And Dean was the person for who the Felix Awards were.
Yes, so Dean Felix Dunlop. So, and that was Jeff Kennedy's idea. He sort of came to us at one, not long after Dean had died, and said, you know, we need an Oscars for the Wellington hospital industry, and we should call it, you know, we should name it after Dean. And
what
his,
an amazing
his memory.
Legacy to have.
Yeah, and that became the Felix Awards, which then became obviously the Lewishams in Auckland, and that model has been followed everywhere else. So yes, I mean, Dean was, you know, was obviously a large driver of that restaurant, a lot of the energy behind it, you know, barely controlled him at times. Most of the time, actually, with Deadly, it was just like, you know, you know, that was part of the joy of working there. It was just this high octane environment where every day was, you know, you do 16 hours in a day there, and it would just fly by, you know. And Julie, you know, when brunches first started in this town, like brunch was a new thing, and there'd be queues at your place to get in down, you know, down the street, and they'd be, and it flipped, they'd be queued down the stairs. And you really do like 240 people for brunch on a Sunday, and it was like nothing that anybody had ever seen before.
Yeah, I remember the invention of the brunch. Mm. I do love a good brunch. Doesn't seem to be quite as sort of fashionable anymore, but I
think we're all used to doing it. But back then, it was an event, like, you know, it was this new thing. And I remember, you know,
the endless bubbles.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You know, and
cheap
yeah, and we sort of had to have explanations after things, like what Eggs Benedict was. Yeah. You know, or, you know, it was like, you know, you just like Eggs Benedict. Anybody knew what it was. You had to go, you know, a muffin with some spinach and some ham and this hollandaise sauce, which normally you put on asparagus. Why do you put it on eggs? You know, it was,
I want to talk a bit more about that in a while, actually, because that must have been one of the most incredible things in that era, was the palates of the customer were not as well travelled, or as possibly the expectations were a little bit different in those days. But we'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. Well, thank you, Boz. And Lois, Brooklyn Bar and Grill.
Well, for me, it was absolutely wonderful that I was getting going in restaurants in the 1970s and then 80s, because this was the time when when daytime food started to be taken seriously, and it was daytime food that I was most interested in doing and most able to do because I still had four teenage children at home at that stage, and probably Julie too, the daytime, the recognition that what you ate in the daytime could be carefully worked out and thought about was quite a new thing. A bit earlier, there were cafeterias and all the in all the government departments, and a lot of people just ate in cafeterias or in very dull little sort of sandwich bars scattered along the streets. But this idea that you could have a dish or a bowl of something freshly made and lovely to eat was quite new. And I experienced this first when I was working in the Wellington settlement in Willis Street, which some of you will remember. With Helen Anderson was the chef there. At that stage, we were still serving this lunchtime food from Bain Marie's, which was something which I think have completely disappeared now. But and I was trying to think what I used to make. I only did lunches on Fridays there. And the only thing I can remember was a pilaf with chicken livers on top. It sounds absolutely awful now, but it's the only thing I can remember. But then when I moved on to buying from working for Jeff Kennedy at his little Toad Hall in Bowen Street, and then buying it from him a few months later, that's where this mood of really good food at lunchtime really got going in for me and for the whole of Wellington, really.
Wow. Yeah.
And I've never, until Brooklyn Cafe and Grill, daytime food has always been what I have been most taken with, most interested in, and the whole notion of lunch. Never been a brunch fan, but the notion of breakfast and then a gap and then lunch is what suits me.
Oh, I don't think you need a gap. I say just extreme eating is what you need to do, like just whenever you can get it.
Yeah.
Do you think, so would it be fair to say that before that era, you're sort of saying that it suddenly became okay to go out for lunch, and you mentioned the cafes and things, so was it really special occasion dining? Was it really what, just hotels and things, was it?
And the initial, it would have been the hotel dining room, which was reasonably formal, white cloths and silver service.
And we had sort of, there was nothing in between. Like, so what Lois was doing at Toad Hall and whatever, and then you kind of had, you know, steakhouses, and then you had fine dining. Mm. You know, there was no, and I think where Flip came in was it was one of the first sort of plug into that that middle zone there, which hadn't kind of been served before. And, you know, there was Orsini's and there was Plymouth House and there was, who was down the bottom of Courtney Place? Casey Corey's place. The Normandy.
Yeah.
I mean, they were kind of, again, quite formal, weren't they?
Yeah,
you know, and very French style, I guess. Yeah.
When I worked at the Normandy, our Saturday nights were flat out. We did nothing in the kitchen because it was all the waiting staff out the front doing good on service trolleys and flopping the tables, you know. And in the kitchen, we'd just be putting up trays and going, there you go. And the chefs, and the waiters would be like, fuck, would you leave me alone?
Yeah.
It was like, shadow brion for two. You put it on the menu. And off they'd go and they'd come back and rinse frying pans and whatever. And there was that kind of level.
Yeah.
So then nothing, that was sort of a step
nothing
down from that.
Nothing casual.
I think it was that lovely fresh lunch food was inspired pretty much from Chez Ilko and Nelson, which he somehow made that something that you would do and get a mussel chowder and salad in a bowl and so on, and that, and also influenced quite a lot by the cookbook, the Moosewood cookbook, which came from a cafe in New York State. Enchanted Broccoli Forest was the next one. So there were these few sort of influences, but it took a little while for them to actually arrive in Wellington at places like the Settlement, or even before the Settlement at Parsons Coffee Bar in Lambton Quay, where Helen Saracen, Harry's wife, was doing little meals in bowls. But that's going way back to the late 50s when I first went there. but it didn't really take off until the 70s, I think. And for me, this has been, well, if it hadn't been for lunch food being something to do, I wouldn't have got into the restaurant business because I wasn't available to work at night. So it was my my saviour, really.
Makes sense. Yes. Gosh, where would we be without you? Okay, so Julie, what about Clark's Food Merchants?
Well, James and I had come back to New Zealand. We were sort of late to the 80s party. So we arrived back in Wellington in 1988, and we really wanted to, well, I really wanted to set up my own business. And I really wanted to do something that was casual, because I had a feeling that New Zealanders would respond very well to breakfast and brunch. And at the same time, as Lois said, there was this whole new, you'd gone from these dull as cafeterias or places where you queued and you got, you know, maybe a curled up sandwich, you know, a white bread sandwich, triangular white bread sandwich. It wasn't very exciting at all. And coming back, we'd been exposed to Europe and all around the place, and table service, so none of this cafeteria stuff. And thinking that, okay, we took over an old butcher shop up in Roseneath, and we thought, right, we're going to do brunch and lunch to start with, and then we did nights, a couple of nights a week. But really, that brunch, the whole idea was of the brunch, but the whole idea also was that we made everything ourselves. So we made our own croissants, we did our own bread. We used to have people that would drive over from Eastbourne to buy the bread on Saturdays and Sundays. And we had 28 seats, and as Martin said, we had queues out the door. And we'd be running from 8 o'clock in the morning until, well, I mean, my day started at 4 o'clock because those croissants needed proving and baking. And actually, the first person that we employed was Mary Daish, Lois's daughter, followed closely by Paul, who appeared one morning when we needed help. But, so that's the idea, was that we wanted something casual. We wanted something casual, and could feel that this was we were at the beginning of something. You know, coffee was just starting to be a thing, you know, espresso coffee. And it was just right place, right time, really, and people responded extremely well to what we offered them.
Wow. And so how was the ingredient situation? Because I remember in Australia, my mother was a caterer and had a gourmet food store, but I remember it was like radishes, iceberg lettuce and curly spring onions were pretty much the, you know, that was the choice for salads, pretty much as far. Like, was it hard to source ingredients?
I think at the beginning it was a fairly standard issue, but I think in a way the restaurants probably pushed for a demand for a difference, and so it was about supply or availability. And I think that restaurateurs, you know, started looking at, you know, all those books you're talking about and influence we're talking about. Well, why can't we get, you know, radicchio?
So you kind of had a role in developing.
And
asking. But trying to go to the growers, and they just couldn't believe that they had anything that we might be vaguely interested in.
Yeah. I think we were lucky as well. Like John Coleman was. Produce services, right? And John Coleman was, and I don't think he's given anywhere near enough credit. For the amazing work that John did, and that he smuggled seeds in. From overseas and went to growers and said, could you plant these, you know? We could tell that story now. But
no, I'm not saying that.
There's probably other stuff that John smuggled in as well. John had his feet. But, you know, and I mean, mescaline lettuce, which we take for granted now, we largely had John to thank for that, I think. And then, you know, there was stuff that we were getting then that you can't get now. And like, I remember going to John's fridges one day and there's little punnets of like those little tiny champagne grapes, grapes. I haven't seen those for years.
They were gorgeous, right?
They were fantastic. Yeah. So there was, you know, cherry tomatoes and the yellow pear tomatoes. Finger limes, of course, So I think John had a lot to do that. And as Grant said, then we would go, you could go to someone like John and go, figs or whatever, and he would, I mean, like John was like, you know, whenever you ordered avocados from John, they were always ripe because he had this blanket behind which he was ripening avocados, you know.
And I believe you didn't smash them then. No, you didn't.
You cut them in half and serve them in vinaigrette. So I think it became driven, like, you know, by restaurants, I think, making those demands of like what you know, or not demands, but requests, saying, what about this? Because we'd read about it or seen it and, you know, we were looking for it.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of also, you know, the providers or the suppliers were in tandem with the expanding and changing palette, wasn't it? So, you know, once things started moving, you know, someone set up a fresh herb business and, right, and then John...
Fresh pasta.
...became fresh pasta. John became supplier and always was trying to find the unusual and the different and supply. So it was a good, you know, tandem thing. I mean, I think exciting, the worst example for us was at the beginning trying to get fresh mussels and, you know, like we're surrounded, but it took a long time to persuade somebody from the Sounds to send us up quarter of a sack on a weekly basis because prior to that, they just couldn't be bothered.
Yeah, they
were just sending them all overseas. Yeah. So there was some demand that we want to start using our own stuff. So and where are we going to find that?
And as people started coming back from the overseas travels, that people started understanding what we were trying to do more and being more adventurous and actually eating out in that middle market.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fine dining, that sort of top-end market, that was sort of kept for special occasions.
Yeah.
But, you know, the brunch, the lunch.
And fresh, all those fresh.
Yeah, and casual to suit our eating style.
The various models that kind of evolved reflected our changing approach to eating, I think, and our changing approach to being a bit more adventurous and, you know, looking at more casual style, definitely. Mm. Yeah, and then the coffee revolution, really.
Yeah.
And, Boz, you had a very unusual way of sourcing figs.
Yeah, I just put my now ex-wife on the roof of the car, and which is not the reason she's my ex-wife, there's other reasons about that.
It's a much bigger conversation
for a different forum. So we discovered figs were growing, and they still are there on trees in Mount Victoria up in Elizabeth Street. And so when we'd finished work at the restaurant, we had this little fair Uno, and she'd perch on the top of the roof of the car, and I'd drive slowly up the footpath so she could reach up into the trees and she'd pick all these figs. We'd have them on the restaurant the next day. They weren't actually the best for figs, but they were fresh figs, and you couldn't get them anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what we had to do to get them. You know, and people would go, "Where did you get those fresh figs?" It was like, "No, you know, get them grown
so
for
here's
us."
An old Martin menu from Germany, and you've got pheasant breast, figs, beetroot, coomera, port wine sauce. Are those figs from Mount Victoria?
Yeah, that would have been. Yeah, totally would have been. Yeah, absolutely.
Thankfully, there was only about 12 seats.
And nowadays, you call them Mount Victoria figs.
Yeah, absolutely.
You'd have to call them Mount Victoria
figs. Absolutely. And how many kilometres from that road to the restaurant and all that sort of
thing?
Yeah.
But with Flip, though, we were getting. We put a fresh, what everybody knows is salad caprese now, but it was like tomato, mozzarella and basil with extra virgin olive oil salad, you know, on the menu.
Yeah.
And that fresh mozzarella we were getting from an old lady out in Island Bay who made it for us once a week. And she'd get up at like 4 a.m. and she was hand stretching it and hand rolling it. And I'd go out to, and she spoke very little English. And we'd found her, she was actually the grandmother of the guy that owned, Joe and Gino, right?
Yeah.
The fish shop. And so I'd go out and I'd buy these 4 balls of mozzarella. That was it for the week, of fresh mozzarella. And they'd still be dripping. And mozzarella back then was hard and it was shrink-wrapped and it was used for pizzas.
Yeah.
And it was great. And like this idea of this fresh milk cheese.
Nobody knew what it was.
No one knew what it was. And that's where I saw my first globe artichokes. They were growing in her back garden. I'm like, what are those? You know?
Yeah.
And, she was growing Italian plum tomatoes. It was like, well, what's that? You know?
And you always had to pay cash.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And she counted it.
She's a good woman.
And all the bottles of milk that she bought from the ordinary milkman were there. So that was the... I'm glad you mentioned that because for me and doing mostly daytime food, it was the advent of the white cheeses of several kinds that really was a huge addition to our menus. Because we did have cottage cheese and cream cheese, but when ricotta, halloumi, mozzarella,
feta, especially feta,
I think, was really embraced by casual food, and it made a huge difference to our menus, to the taste. Having these lovely sort of fresh, cheesy taste, but also the look for a dish to have something white, something beautifully white in the dish instead of the image of cheese as being something yellow. This to me was a real step forward. For me, I think perhaps more than all the fruit and vegetables, because I'm quite traditional and all those things and managed to make quite nice food using, you know, carrots and beetroot and cabbage and iceberg lettuce. But it was those white cheeses that really were extremely helpful, weren't they?
Yeah. Because cheese was just the kilo block. The big block of cheddar. And that was pretty much it. Cottage cheese and cream cheese.
And I think it was the same cheese that was labelled mild, tasty, cottage, whatever. It didn't appear to have that much difference to it.
And Gruyere.
At the beginning of New Zealand cheese, artisan cheese production, I think Evansdale.
Capity Cheeses was just getting going.
Just before that we used to get cheese up from Otago, Evansdale, and I think that was the first, you know, farmhouse cheese.
That big farmhouse cheese.
And then it kind of rolled
off. In the 60s, a very thriving, there were a lot of little dairy companies. Out of around Taranaki, which is sort of, I'm from Whanganui, but around Taranaki you used to be able to get these beautiful cheeses that were made, they were made by the dairy companies. But then in the 80s, they were all bought up and those cheeses were lost. And then they started to come back again, probably late 80s.
And Barry's Bay. I think that's still going. But again, that was probably, again, reflection of changing agriculture and marketing and, you know, and probably authoritarian regulations.
And you mentioned New Zealand mussels then. What was the New Zealand seafood story at that stage? Was there one?
Woeful.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
I mean, they were kind of like the Greek and Italian families fishing.
Yeah, and it's all, and they very much controlled it. But, you know, there was nothing like the range, anywhere near the range that you got now. Pacific oysters still weren't really a thing. In fact, rock oysters, Pacific oysters, were only really sold in Auckland restaurants. Bluff oyster was the king. That was that was it. You got whitebait during whitebait season. And if you rang your fish supplier, if you didn't go down there to go through the fish window, you got offered Tiriki, Orange Ruffy, maybe Crowfoot or something. Well, it was Orange Ruffy, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it was pretty limited. And you know, but that didn't change for a long time. That didn't change until maybe only a decade ago, really.
And that's when you went on to do the yacht club.
Yeah, with seafood there. Oh. But it wasn't great. I mean, I remember like going down with my first restaurant, Givenay, the little one, going down to John Gino's, which was in Cuba Mall. And you know, there was this window with like garfish in there and all these other fish. And I'm like, what is that? You know, so the 3 or 4 years prior of working in hotels and restaurants, I'd only ever seen the one fish that only ever came as a fillet, and usually it came in a plastic bag with a knot on the top that was just dropped on your bench, and the fillets were all folded and broken. And you know,
crazy given that we're surrounded by the sea, and recreationally we were fishing all sorts of things. And
the quality was often not very good.
It was often a pier screaming every day at the fishmonger.
Well, of course, technology has changed now,
and all these guys smoked as well, right? So you'd go in and go, I'll have that. And they'd be like, and they'd just forget and be like, and it was just, and then hand it over and be like, and off they went again. And it was,
puts a new connotation.
I think it was very much a commodity, wasn't it, for them? It's like, how many kilos can we sell it? Even though they were Greek and Italian, their commercial, I'm sure at home they were eating all sorts of different things, but their commercial businesses were pretty rough and ready, as you say.
Well, fresh squid was $1 a kilo.
Yeah,
that's right.
It was, and nobody sort of knew what it was.
Right.
Or what to do with it.
Or what to do with it. So,
my God, give anything for fresh squid.
I know. It was beautiful.
I keep sending the husband out to catch some, and he keeps coming home empty-handed.
What?
It's not good. He's on thin ice.
Ring
thin ice. Good. I know someone. I wanted to talk a little bit about the actual, was there competition the way there is now? I mean, there weren't as many restaurants. Was it a feeling of sort of everybody had their own patch and there was enough for everybody? What was the feeling?
I think it was more collegial.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that's always been great about the Wellington food scene is it's always been collegial.
There is a real feeling of collaboration.
Absolutely, and it's always been restaurants have really supported each other. Yeah. You know, I remember when the White House had a fire in their kitchen a few years ago and there was that power cut on Ferguson Street and a whole lot of restaurants down there were in trouble. Other restaurants rang up and said, what do you need?
Yeah.
You know, come and do your prep here. Yeah. You know, we've got room on the stove, whatever. Like, it wasn't like, huh, that's it, there's screw, we can jump in.
Yeah.
It's always been about helping each other out.
It's the customers that are the enemy, not the restaurant. It's the customers we have to jolly well deal with.
But I don't know. I mean, that's how I always felt. I always felt that it was, you know.
I think we just numbers, but at the same time, I mean, just yesterday when I was getting this thing organised for the next few days, I'm going, even though it's 30 years ago, I'm in prefab, you know, because Jeff's part of it, the venue's part of it, but like you just, you know, I'm talking to Moore Wilsons and talking to the guys at prefab, like we all know each other from 30 years ago, so it makes it really straightforward. You know who to talk to, you know, and they're all willing and enthusiastic about, you know, what we're doing. And so those old connections still remain, and I think there's a lot of strong friendships were made, and we're still working together.
And I think we were because we were charting new territory. Yeah. I think we were all very. I always remember having a conversation with Mark Limmaker about sorbets, and he was so generous with his. I was slightly nervous about approaching him. Yeah. I'd kind of known him from. I used to waitress at Bellamy's, and he was a junior chef then, and I sort of knew him, so I sort of sidled up. And I said, oh, look, I'm having real trouble with my sorbets. And he was just so, he was really helpful. And he actually came round to Clark's, came and had a look at what we were doing, came and, you know, came and walked me through it all. And that kind of thing I don't think would have happened anywhere else.
But there was a division between the restaurant tribe, like us, and the hotel tribe. So I think that was quite a division. The hotel people who had been gone through apprenticeships and gone to polytechs and were going through that track, and then there were people more like us who came from a different track, often untrained.
Sorry, Martin,
When I first got to know Jeff Kennedy and told, this was back in the 70s, and told him that I was planning to go to Polytech. And he said, oh, don't go there. They'll unlearn you.
Yeah.
and there was this sort of feeling that people coming from being keen home cooks.
He was right.
Could have a sort of fresh and different approach. And when people were applying for jobs with me through my various places, the three places that I had, I would be quite a lot more wary of people who were formally trained than I was with people who just simply loved cooking, because the formally trained ones would want to keep to the procedures, the strategies, and their food would end up looking very set.
And it was very English, British. Hospitality.
A lot of the tutors were from the British army, so there was a difference. And I think that cooperation between people like us didn't, unfortunately probably, didn't extend to the hotel cooks. Although when I did go, despite Jeff telling me not to go to Polytech, I did. And I was, at that time, I think I was in my early 30s, and everybody else in the class were 18-year-old boys, the sort of boys who'd been told, well, you're pretty dumb, but you could probably cook. But then as the years went by, I did run into several of these chaps who'd been these uncouth 18-year-olds, and they were now executive chefs of hotels all around Wellington and doing very well. So they'd been misjudged by their teachers, and they gradually started to learn about relaxing food a bit more in the way that we felt that we did.
Yeah.
And so why did you go to...
There was nowhere else for him to go.
Straight from school, did you?
So one of my first jobs while I was still at Onslow College. I was at school with Mike. And Onslow College. And I got a job at the Burma Motor Lodge, as it was then, which is now Dame Melvina Major, I think. And as the afternoon day porter. But I hated it. I was meant to set fires and clean conference centres down and things. But I sort of fell into the kitchen. I was like being totally smitten by what was going on in there. And I met a guy in there who was working there as a waiter, but he was opening up his own restaurant, which became Fraser's on Tinakori Road. And he said, I'll take you on as an apprentice. You've got to get school C first though, otherwise you don't get a job. So that was the incentive to finish school C, which I barely made it through. And I literally left school one day and started with him the next day. But the apprenticeship system was really formal. That's what he did. And I went to Polytech 2 days a week, and one of those days was my day off. So you were really heavily committed to it. So you'd go in the morning and then work that night. And then from there I moved on into hotels. And again, it was block release. So I just kind of finished that formal training off, but it was absolutely hideous. It really was. It was everything you just described it. I think I started to learn how to cook once I left Polytech and saw what was going on around me, and I thought, well, that's, you know, why do we have to do that? Why does the meat have to be at 3 o'clock on the plate? It was so prescriptive, you know?
Yeah. Mm. But talking about also the difference between the hotel and the rest of you, as you say, that they would have had a more sort of brigade mentality, wouldn't they, to the whole approach like staffing and all that sort of thing. Everybody had their station.
Much more, I think, male-dominated kitchens than, I mean, we probably all had not even spread, but there wasn't sort of such a thing.
Yeah. For women?
I mean, it was much harder.
Real hard.
The attitude was really, what the hell do you think you're doing here? So I worked briefly in Auckland in the early 80s, and I asked a chef a question. It was my second day working for him, and he threw a knife at me. So I thought, at that stage, I thought to myself, I'm not putting up with this. So I went and talked to the boss. I said, look, I want a week's pay or else I'm going to the police. I thought, this is ridiculous. And I ended up working with Joe Seeger and Helen Brabazon at Harley's, and they were two nurses. So they'd set up this casual place in Auckland called Harley's, and it was the first restaurant to get 5 stars in Metro from Warwick Road. And it was really casual and really fun, and they had a completely different view of how you worked, and in a way they really grounded me in how a kitchen, proper behaviour in a kitchen, you know, there was no bullying, no all those things that happened.
But that was quite, obviously outrageous in those days, but it was kind of accepted, wasn't it, that was the way that you were going to behave. It was...
People were hit, but it was accepted, it wasn't questioned.
Well, you know, with an Austrian sous chef, one of the hotels, if you weren't working fast enough, you would get poked with a carving fork, right, which he just kept in his back pocket all the time. And I mean, drew blood poked, you know, it would be across the waistline of your apron string went round, right? And one day when I turned on him and I said, you fucking do that one more time, right? And then, you know, very different situations about to unfold. And he turned around, he lifted up his chef's jacket and just showed me all the scars along his back. And he said, as was done to me, so shall I do to you. And it was like, that's just how it kind of unfolded. That's just kind of what the deal was, you know. But you learned to move quick.
But it's really good now because it's equal. And I see the young men that come into our kitchens now, they've always worked with women. They have no issue. No. It's just life. It's how it is. And I love that. I think we've come a huge way.
I think too, because we were all involved in smaller, scale, there was no room for that kind of hierarchical. Everyone had to be adept or be able to move between places.
I think that's always been one of our secrets to our success is overseas.
Yeah.
You know, with Kiwi chefs going overseas has been, because we've worked in these environments where you have to do everything, which is one minute you can be portioning the fish, and the next minute you're making the creme brulee, you know, because that's because they need to be made, right, for service tonight. So someone, you know, there's no pastry chef, baker, whatever, whose job it is to do that. So you became a sort of jack of all trades, right? So when you arrived overseas, it was like, where do you want me?
Yeah.
In the kitchen, because I can actually pretty much do.
I'm only going to do this.
And they go, well, you know, you're a saucier, you're a poissonnier. Well, we're there to go, like, what do you want me to do? Like, I can do that. We were, because we all had to pitch in and, you know, and get stuck in to get the, get the prep done to get the restaurant open.
The other collegial sort of aspect too is that many of us in the scene have either worked with each other or for each other at various times. So I think there's always been a, you know, a currency between.
We dine in each other's restaurants, right, as well, you know?
Very much.
You know? But you say, Julie, that you think it's more equal now. It's not equal at our place. I still do 3 days before the barbecue, marinating everything and making all the salads, and the husband swans out to the barbecue at 12:45 in the afternoon, and they get all the praise, and nobody recognises.
You should have married a Kiwi.
Well, there's still time.
He's
on thin ice.
But he does do a good paella.
Yeah, that's true. That's the reason he's still there.
Yeah, but you mentioned paella, right? I mean, I remember Sabato was just starting up at the, back then as well. I remember like Jackie Dixon arriving one day in the flip with Kona Raleigh rice.
Yeah.
Right? Which, you know, we'd never seen before, Kona Raleigh or Arborio, you know, as it became wider known. And, you know, for this thing called risotto, which we put on the menu at Flip. And, you know, and night after night it would get sent. And I'd read Waverley Roots Food of Italy about these lovely creamy risottos, and I followed the recipe and I got it right. And I'd got this thing called Alondo, which is the wave of the risotto falling over the pan and whatever. We'd sue it, we'd send it out, and night after night it would get sent back to the kitchen for being this gluggy rice. Right? And one night Dean came and he threw the plate across the kitchen. He said, "That's it, no more fucking risotto on this menu." He said, "We take it off tomorrow, that's it." So we took it off the menu, and weeks later, we were presented with a petition, which I've still got somewhere. And it was bring back the flip gluggy rice. And there's about 2,000, all right? And there's about 2,000 signatures on it for people going, bring it back. So we did. So, you know, it was a real. Well, we had to really persevere with that.
Yeah.
Now I guarantee everybody sitting there makes risotto and knows how to make it and gets good rice and understands. Because, you know, back then it was risotto was stir fried with peas and carrots and God knows what else.
I mean. Apart from the availability of ingredients, I mean, we were kind of learning on the job by travelling ourselves or going to places, to schools and other parts of the world. I mean, even though we were using polenta in New Zealand, it was always, at that stage, it was always baked or fried. And it took a trip to Italy to see how it's actually meant to be used, which is the soft polenta on the board and then the leftovers you use.
That's right,
and so. We were kind of educating ourselves very much along the way, and I think, I don't know, we always used to go to Sydney, Melbourne, because they always seemed to be a few pitches ahead to be inspired and come back, or, as I said, we'd all try and travel every year.
We'd go to Sydney and steal things.
Did you?
Yeah.
What, recipes or knives and forks?
And knives and forks and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, we'd bring them back to copy them. And Dean and I go into Taylor Square in Sydney when Taylor Square was like the place in Sydney to go to. I mean, where it was a busy Friday night. Dean wanted to get out of there quickly because he wanted to go and see the Kylie show up at the front. And they had these little silver table talkers, right, which you see everywhere things that you drop the card in.
Yeah.
You couldn't buy those in New Zealand at the time. Mm. And we were sitting there and Dean's like, steal it.
Right.
I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And he goes, put it in your pocket. I'm like, if I get caught, like, just quickly put it in your pocket. She's not coming. So I grabbed his tail today, the whole thing, inside my jacket pocket, sweating through the rest of dinner. They're going to come back and go, anybody seen our table talker?
Yeah.
Come on, somebody's missing from the table, and we all know what it is. Right, and we get up to pay.
Burning a hole in your pocket,
and we're walking down the stairs, and I'm like, you know, the head is pounding, going, no. I can feel the tap on the shoulder.
You could do months in prison for something like that.
And a precursor of things to come. And we brought it back, and we went to Metric Sheet Metals and said to Graham out there, we need 80 of these.
Yeah.
And Graham went, fine. You know, now you can buy them everywhere. But it was, and of course, then we put them on the tables, and everybody came in and go, "Wow, those, those are cool. Like, where did you get those? And we want those as well." Yeah. And it was, you know, so everything kind of grew, you know, like as.
And it was a growing of ambience and style
in terms of interiors and things as well. I mean, we had a thing, but I think, again, because we were probably all, trying to look for the next thing or the...
Beautiful French wallpaper you had on the pier when you made over piers. So it was just like... Yeah. People are raving about the wallpaper. You've got to go to Pierce and see the wallpaper.
Like the inside of a car's stomach.
So my question would be on that. You spoke the other night. I mean, we've talked about this quite a bit, but the sort of the cultural cringe and the... Yes, I know that New Zealanders are very humble. When I first got here, I was, sort of saying you all need to sort of get over yourselves and get on your soapbox a little bit more and actually stand up and be proud and tell your story, because it's all that, we know we're really good, but it's not our job to sort of, crow about it. And you are, like, that's getting better. And, of course, at a time now when around the country you see, restaurants really, really trying to tell a New Zealand story and very proud about being uniquely New Zealand. But at that time, was there a shift? Because at that time, it feels like it was all about trying to imitate.
I think part of it was the actual, restaurant scene itself was probably, at its early stages, it was actually a lot of Europeans who set up places. So immediately you had, not necessarily French, but you had a kind of European approach. And then I think what Lois is talking about.
Lois for me.
I mean,
I'm going to Lois to Cook and Cafe and Grill.
Starting to become, without maybe necessarily identifying it or being strident about it, we've got our own approach. We're not trying to be French. I mean,
going to Cafe. I mean, I live just up the road from the Cafe and Grill. We went to the Colonnade. And Lois was one of the first people that put provenance on her menu of where her chicken was coming from.
Yeah.
And also the names of all your cooks that were cooking that night.
Yeah.
That was in the 80s. I mean, and that's the thing that people was just like kind of just doing now, acknowledging who was who's in the kitchen tonight, who's cooking
dinner.
It was fantastic. But and there's this provenance all through your menu where that acknowledgement. For me, it was Lois that kind of, had an influence over me on that.
Simple ingredient focused food. That's what I can remember about
There's one thing I think that we're all cooks and we love cooking, but I think there's something that we would probably all agree about is that you have to be not just somebody that's interested in cooking to run a restaurant. What you really have to be interested in is setting up the drama, the theatre of a restaurant every lunchtime, every breakfast, every night. So you're setting up this wonderfully complex interaction between the cooks, the waiters, the kitchen hands, the customers, who are all play their part and play their role in making this drama come to life.
The sociology of a restaurant is fascinating because it's actually producing and selling under the same roof.
Yeah,
so the cogs and the interactions
The cringe started to move when we started to take ourselves seriously and do that. We started to create atmospheres for ourselves, visions that we had, and that's when the cringe started to move. And it was, I want to do this. This is my vision and this is how I'm going to do it. And suddenly it was, I don't have to reference anybody else. This is...
And I think, again, the increasing availability of product allowed, us to play more, I suppose, with what was in our backyard.
I think it's also that... it's almost, we were talking about this, it's almost a love affair. I remember reading in Martin's beautiful, beautiful book, that feeling that you had when you sat in your restaurant and you looked around the restaurant and you looked at the sculptures and the art and the linen tablecloths and the beautiful glassware, and you got butterflies before every service, customer walked in the door, because you were creating. It was this love affair. And for me, that's why we go out. We go out to restaurants because of that that entire experience that you create. Mm. It is very much about the food, but it's also about all of those other layers. Well,
and there's an energy that comes when, you know, everything's working and in sync, and you go, oh, isn't this amazing?
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, that's the good vibe, I think.
That's the art of service. Hospitality.
You know, when that service is 100%, you know, it's run beautifully,
and it's
smoothly.
All
you've been,
Once a year, that happens.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Twice, baby.
But the customers have to play their role.
Yes.
I think we.
They just have to be managed.
No, without the customers, of course, we wouldn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And customers do. I think over the years have increasingly learned how to be a customer and how to relate to the waiters, how to relate to the food, so that it's an interaction between the customers and the people in the restaurant. And unless both sides are interacting well, it's just not going to work. And there are a few people here who I remember as wonderful customers who realise that their role was to be a good customer. There's one person here who I remember well, used to sometimes come to Brooklyn Cafe and Grill and just look at me and say, what do you think I feel like eating tonight? And I would look at him and perhaps suggest something which he would generally accept, I think. And I thought that was just the acme of somebody being a customer, but also being part of the whole drama of the restaurant.
And I mean, regular customers are vital to any successful restaurant, and it does become a relationship, you know, which is maybe specific to that situation, but it's part of the family, isn't it? You know, like the people become part of the whole environment and part of the identity of the restaurant, I suppose.
And that may well have been the beginning of the Trust the Chef menu, Lois.
Of
the Trust the Chef menu that we all see now when we go into the restaurant and we just let the chef feed me.
Yeah.
Very quickly, has anybody got any questions for the panel from the audience? Oh, we've got a couple of these. Ladies first, Beth. Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Rowan. I just feel like I'm in the presence of greatness. I just want to know from each of you just what you're excited about in the Wellington food scene now. Like what sort of, what do you see the future of Wellington food being?
Wellington food. What am I excited about? I'm excited about coming back to my roots. I don't know. I just it's got a great energy. I mean, I've kind of been hanging out at Prefab obviously a lot over the last few days as we set up, and you know, Jeff and all those kind of connections. And I think there's an energy. Yeah, you know, part of it is because I think Wellington is geographically enclosed in terms of the city, and so it's a great city in the sense that you can walk across it. You always bump into someone you know, paths cross. And so I think that kind of physicality actually goes into all sorts of things that happen in Wellington. You know, I would just think it's a city, but it's kind of a big village as well, because you're kind of in the know, or you know someone in the know. And so what I always enjoy down here is like Florida, the energy, there's some sort of specific Wellington energy about Wellington restaurants or bars. I don't know, and it's kind of like, I don't know, like something I tap into and really enjoy. So I think it's in good hands, you know, and I think it always will be an exciting food, has a tradition of, you know, of great food culture, and I think it always will have, and I think that's part of the location. I think it's part of the kind of people that live in Wellington, and yeah, so it's always exciting to go.
Martin,
sorry,
we're getting wound up.
Yeah,
sorry,
darling. I'll keep it brief. I think Wellington lost its way a few years ago.
and nothing great happened. And I was really worried about it. It was like, you know, there was nothing exciting opening. We just kind of stagnated for a period there. We seem to have got that, there's kind of that energy level back. And a couple of weekends ago, I did two lunches with Monique up at Hiako. Mm. So Monique sort of started with me. And, you know, and what impressed me the most about those 2 days was just that the sheer youthful passion and skill level of the cooks and the floor staff working in her restaurant. And I thought, you know, I thought if that's indicative of where the industry's at in this town, then we're in really good hands. Mm. And I think the future looks really exciting for Wellington again. And, you know, you can see whether, you know, with new places are opening, even with the sort of post-COVID world, we don't seem to have lost our enthusiasm for dining out or for exploring new ground. And I just think, you know, yeah, that's what excites me most, is just that youthful energy that's there that, you know.
I think, you know, it's sort of kind of like we were saying before, someone saying, well, yeah, we were all kind of gaining our own confidence and things. But I think now the industry and the whole world is, New Zealand food scene is established enough for people to be, you know, people like Monique and the front of house. I mean, there's a confidence now because the foundation's been laid, you know. So, I mean, we've already gone, you know, and so now we're just starting from another platform, really, aren't we? Confidence and that it is a record, you know, it's serious. Oh, yeah, not serious, but it's a real thing, a real career, a real,
It is a real career, and I get very excited by the new energy that you're talking about, and you can see it and feel it. But I do worry about where's that energy for front of house? Where is the validation for the front of house staff? Because they need a career path as well, a serious career path.
Mm. Yeah, and Lois, any thoughts?
Well, certainly the technical skill and the amazing equipment that some restaurants have now. The only one I'm really a bit familiar with is my son-in-law's place, Rita, in Aro Street, and the skill, the exquisite skill of those cooks, and backed up by the extraordinary equipment that they have, so that they can actually move into putting together food in different ways. Is just wonderful. But at the same time, I still really like to go to Chocolate Fish at Shelley Bay and have a fish sandwich and a couple of days ago I had a sausage roll at the little cafe in Kilburnie. Nice, and that sort of eating to me is really important too. You know, there is the amazing sort of stuff.
You watch a stampede, it was all out to Kilburnie now to find
that. I'll just write that one down.
Lois Dacey found the best sauce gone in Wellington.
Can I have your number, please, Lois? I'll give you a little rig later. One more question there from that gentleman.
Question for Lois. Before I ask the question, I think we're all sitting here wishing that all four of these establishments from the 80s could be reopened again so we could start going back to them. Question for Lois is, Lois, when I asked you to tell me what I was going to eat, give me a couple of reminders of things that I ate as a result of what you chose for me.
I couldn't quite catch the question.
A question of what were a couple of the dishes that you recommended that I should eat when I asked you to tell me.
What did Lindsay get fed?
You know who you are. No, that's the... Yes, the exquisite cooperation between and trust between customer and restaurateur.
And do you remember what any of those dishes were, Lois? Do you remember what any of those dishes were?
No,
too far. You weren't the only one, you know. All right, look, I think it's time to finish up. So thank you so much all for coming. And can I have a round of applause for our amazing panel?
Thank you, Jerry.
And just before I hand back to Sarah, I just would like to say that you are all so incredibly privileged to have the Welly on a Plate team and Visa Wellington on a Plate Festival, because I've been to a lot of festivals, but this one is just so diverse and so all-encompassing and so much fun. And these guys have done such a terrific job, especially at this time when the hospitality industry needs them more than ever, to completely turn this event inside out this year. And they've done just a tremendous job. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. You guys make me feel very proud of the hospo scene here in Wellington and to play a part in it. And some of those stories I remember. I grew up in a restaurant, in the back of a restaurant at least, and as a child remember being sent out, well, as a teenager, to the lady in Island Bay to pick up the mozzarella when I had my learner's license, and to the guy in Hai Tai Tai who used to do the olives, and he'd put his hand in that big vat and he'd come out with olive oil up to his kind of armpit. Yeah, you just don't realise actually how hard it was in those days to kind of get things we take for granted now. These guys are all involved in a sold out series of dinners this week, which is fantastic, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, along with Jeff Kennedy, Grant Kinnear, and James Pedersen, which is fantastic. Can't wait for Friday night. It'll be really exciting. And next week is the final chapter of the Wellington Food Story Speaker Series presented by Te Papa. We look forward to presenting our hearing from owners of the current iconic establishments here in Wellington and perhaps some more of the sort of fast food and fun eats that we have here in Wellington. So we're going to hear from Taste of Home, Soul Shack, Little Penang and Tommy Millions. So if you're keen to hear more about sort of what's happening and looking forward to the future, that's 12 o'clock right here next Wednesday. Beautiful. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to the special series of Honeycomb episodes in collaboration with Visa Wellington on a Plate. We're bringing you another episode next week, so make sure you subscribe to this podcast on your favourite listening app.